How's it going, Emmanuel?
Hi, it's going well. How are you?
Very well myself. Nice to finally chat with you. I appreciate you doing the AMA on Reddit and then this chat, and really excited to talk to you. I think what you're doing is not only nice already, but how should I put this? Far from the peak. I think you've got a long way to the peak, so it's looking like it's going up for you from this moment onwards.
I think so. I think what we do, no code in general, but the way we do it in particular, which is, really going far into how far you can go and how much you can do without code, it's an endless potential. Because at the end of the day, software is everywhere. Software is expensive, hard to create. The people that will make it easy will become one of the most important companies out there, and that's very much what I hope to be. So.
I want to get into no code and all that, but first I want to start with how are you? And I genuinely mean how are you. So not just the polite way of saying it. I mean, there's been a pandemic, everything. People have been had have had to go through tough times. How are things going for you in your life? Is everything okay?
Not good, actually. Yeah, I just had a little girl. Work busy, but good. I mean, like as most companies on the internet, the pandemic really helped us in some ways. That drove adoption dramatically. So it's been intense for the team, and it's a little bit weird to not being able to see each other because we used to be very much of an office culture, and we were forced to become remote. So that was tough at times, but overall, the team is pretty happy because, you want to be at a company that is doing well, especially when a lot of people around you are not doing well. Sometimes, I keep reminding the team, we have to feel fortunate here because we are fortunate, and we have to be aware of this because a lot of people are having it much harder than we have. And then, yeah, personally, I just had a baby, so it was a pretty productive pandemic. I would say the toughest thing that I had to go through, and it's okay, but was still a little bit unfortunate because I'm still very connected to my home country, to France, and I used to go back, literally every 6 or 7 weeks, and I've not been back, for a year and a half now, and I haven't seen my family for that time. So that's the one negative thing of the pandemic, but otherwise, I can't complain really.
Where are you located now?
I'm in New York.
Okay, nice. So is that Bubbles headquarters?
Yeah, I mean, legally speaking, yes. I would say today we probably have 60% of the team in New York. We have an office. Some people use it. Sometimes I use it myself. But now we started hiring in a very, I think we're like 17 or 18 states today in the US. We have some in France, some in Mexico. So starting to become more and more global.
Nice. Have you? This is just where my mind veered. Like, I have a list of questions. We had people from Reddit asking questions. I'll get to them. Have you had anybody working at Bubble leave and start their own company or their own product, I should say, using Bubble?
Not yet, actually. We don't have a lot of attrition today. We do have people who do things on the side, like the side project on the weekend using Bubble. That's a pretty common thing. We actually give free Bubble access, I mean, to some limits to our employees, and we want them to do that. Making sure that everybody on the team knows the product extremely well, and it's a very rich product. You can do a lot of things with it. It's actually very important for us. So we see that as a great thing. If one day one of our employees comes to me and tells me my side project is going so well that I'm leaving, well, I mean, good for him. It's a good sign, when you start having people on your teams that start companies that do very well. I just hope they're living the best.
It means you've done a good job with Bubble in itself. When I'm pretty sure that will happen at one point.
With the product, but also with the team, right? That means you hire people that do well, and I think that's very important. Today, the team is pretty young, not in age, but in terms of tenure. Most people have been at the company for less than 2 years. So we haven't that wave yet of people leaving, but at some point, every organization will have some people leave the organization to do new things. And it helps the company in many ways because then you start having a network of like bright and smart people doing a lot of things. And we get there. I just think given our development so far, it's probably a little bit early still.
Yeah, I know you're smart enough to see that, so I didn't expect any other answer from you that it is gonna happen because at the end of the day, that's what Bubble is for, as far as I can understand, of empowering people to do these things.
Yeah,
So
exactly. I mean, entrepreneurship is so much at the core of our business because that's what we're selling. You know? So yeah. Someone could, like the sad thing, I think, when you do a company like a startup or any companies, and when someone comes to you and say, hey, I want to go to your competitor, because like, it's like, okay, really, we felt something here, right? But if someone leaves to start a company, especially for us, I wouldn't be sad about this. I mean, I might be sad because the person is great, but in the grand scheme of things, it's actually probably helping the mission of the company.
Yeah, and I guess that's why you started in the first place. So this is my personal belief here. Let me know if you agree or disagree, but I genuinely think as a world, we're going this direction of, hold on, I'm not going to keep you shackled in my company. If you want to leave, fine, because I would rather have successful friends, business connections, or just friends on a personal level than a bird in a cage. And especially...
I think it's basically impossible to retain people, smart people, against their will. I mean, some companies, the biggest companies do that, you know, with money or like benefits or like free lunches. But at some point, smart people don't buy that. So I don't even think what you need to try to do is to keep bringing challenges to them so that they feel excited. But if at some point someone has an idea to start something on his own or their own, it's impossible, I think, to retain them, and that's fine.
Yeah. You've started Bubble in 2012, and I think...
Right, it's been a while, right?
Bubble's birthday has been quite soon, 21st of June, so a couple of weeks ago. Is it 21st of June, like it says on the internet?
It depends how we count the birthday. When Josh and I met for the first time, and we decided to partner and become co-founders on our first coffee meeting. And so if you think in that way, I guess that's the anniversary. That said, the incorporation of the business was August 8, 2012. So maybe it's August 8th. I don't know. I think we should decide when it's the actual start of the company. But yeah, it's basically 9 years ago. Like, so whether it's this month or in August, this is the 9th anniversary of the company.
You've been early with this bet of no code, of making what Bubble is today. It's not like you've been starting, I don't know, an email company today, an email marketing company or something, an industry which is, you know, definitely validated and there's money spent. I mean, there is already money spent into no code, and there was already money spent into making apps and all that stuff. But you're definitely on the early side, bigger risk. You've been patient. If you were in it to make just money and to become very rich ASAP and to flip a company in 3 years, you would have probably burned out in 2014.
That was a wrong idea.
Yeah, yeah. And this is why, you know, sometimes they say that people's actions speak louder than words, or whatever that quote is. I can read between the lines with you that you're in for the long run, because it's already been, and I think we're still far from, we're still not past the tipping point of no code and the need for Bubble. Walk me through, I'm sure you get this question a lot, of what drives you, what motivates you, but how are you hanging on in there? And is it, some people say passion is bullshit, or no, some people say follow your passion is bullshit, some people say no, that's what drove us. What's going on inside Emmanuel's head?
It's tough to respond to that because it's been 9 years. You know, it's almost been a decade. So I guess, if you don't mind, I'll take a little bit of time and tell you the different phases of it, because it's been different, right? I think what drove me and Josh at the very beginning was creating a product that no one had created. And if you look, for people who knew how to use Bubble in 2016 or 2015, it was already really powerful. What we've been doing after that is, you know, making sure it scales better, and that's still something we do today. But in terms of, you know, creating a product that pushes the limits of what you can do without code further than any other team on the planet, we were moving extremely fast between 2012 and 2015. And we had a product that was not too different from what we have today in 2015. It's just got more robust. So the excitement of creating something new was very much there. And the idea is that we're doing something here that people have said is impossible, and that's really cool. And then we started having hard times, because after 3 years, we had that product, but we hadn't found a way really to sell it too much. Not many people were aware that it was even a thing. So we had like a very small community, and we were not making a lot of money. You know, we were basically working on our savings for all these years. And so it got hard. because at some point after 3 years, you're like, wait, it's cool, but why am I doing this? And then I think what kept us going is the more responsibility. So it's much, I wouldn't call that passion. It's more like the commitment that we make to our users. Because since the very beginning, our commitment was to people, hey, you don't need to find engineers to build a company. Trust us, you'll build it on top of us and we'll make it work. It's a big promise you make. And a lot of people at first didn't buy it, but some people did. And they were our early users. Most of these people are people we would actually meet in person, like the early community of users we had in the very early days, 2012, 2013, were in New York and Boston, because we would go there a lot. And so I never felt that I could turn the servers off and be like, sorry guys, this is too long, I can't do anything, because literally we would kill their business, which is probably, I think for these people, we were the most important tool they were using online with Gmail, you know, like, because at some point, if you can't use Facebook, it's fine. You know, like you can survive without it, but suddenly we would entirely shut down their entire operations. And those were not like huge startups, but they were teams with like, you know, 5 or 6 people that would make a living with revenue. And suddenly, you know, you're like, sorry guys, this is over. And it's a big responsibility I was not necessarily willing to take. So that, and then after 2017, we started hiring a team, raising around, and we became more like of the traditional, you know, VC-backed startup in many ways. And then the excitement was still the same thing that we had before, you know, creating something very hard and pushing the limits of what you can do, the commitment to our users. But then I started having, you know, this thing that I didn't really have before, which is, you know, your job for me personally changes every 6 months, just because, you know, when you scale quickly, like suddenly, you know, you hire a lot of people, you raise money and all these things. And so that's kind of the phase I'm into right now, where I have to learn how to scale a business. Like, you know, we were 2 people for 5 years, 12 people at the end of 2018. Today we're 45. So this is starting to really accelerate. And that's a very exciting ride. I don't know if there is passion in any of these things, probably, actually. But I don't use passion as a way to describe it.
Is it because the word doesn't come natural to you, or it's been overused and now it's a dirty word? Or do you just not look at it?
It's not a dirty word. I just don't think it's specific enough.
Cool. You said we were making a lot of money, but you kept going, and I understood why. I think that's an answer that makes a ton of sense. Talk to us about your state of mind. I know state of mind and mindset can sound really, really like neighbors. But as I said, you weren't looking, you were hanging on in there. There was this responsibility that kept you going. Why not look to do something on the side that maybe, so let me put it this way. Some people want to make something big and huge and target market and use these word metaphors. And I've said these exact same words on this podcast before. I'm curious to know, does that not exist in your head, or it exists, but it's in the background of your mind and you're letting your better self trump and drive that?
No, I mean, I've always thought this could be something massive and huge. I just realized pretty quickly that there was a big initial investment to be made, that it was not in months, it was in years before you had a good product. But I remember back in 2012 when we started, Josh and I were talking to each other one day, and be like, if we do this right, this can be one of the biggest things in the world, because software is everywhere. And I never thought of that. Now, when you work for 5 years on an MVP, of course you think about that, but I wouldn't say that what kept us go. I mean, it was part of it, but the moral commitment of our users, because that's something we would have literally every day. You know, every day we would interact with users. We had users that would send us, you know, when they were happy, bottles of champagne, when they were angry because we had bugs, you know, like pretty emotional emails. Like that was more what we were dealing with. That was a big idea. But I always thought this could be, and I still think today, this is one of the biggest opportunities of all time here ahead of us.
I think so as well. So let's take it this way. You made a bet. It paid off. The sole fact that you're still alive as a company, not as a person, the sole fact that you're still alive makes that bet correct. And I would say even further, because you just passed 1 million users a couple of days ago. I've seen the tweet, and you have, for people who might be listening and might not be watching, if you go on Bubble's website, just below the sign-up link, the field where you pop in your email, Join 1,016,715 bubblers today and start building. So congrats, Emmanuel, for that, and to Joshua. What was I going to say? You made this bet looking in the past. Cool, paid off. What bets are you making? Maybe not today, because that might be tactical advantage, but talk to us about how you see no-code going or changing from that initial vision. Now that no-code is starting to spread amongst communities, how do you look? Do you have a hot take or a different take compared to what other people might be saying on the next 1, 2, 5 years of no-code and all this stuff?
I mean, I'll bet compared to all the other players in the space is pretty clear. We're going hard on, let's make the product as flexible as possible, even though it might require some learning. And the other tools are usually not like that. There is a tendency, I think, in technology, in the startup world, to, you know, kind of the Apple influence has to be work, you know, in a few minutes, you know, no learning, it has to be very intuitive. And I actually don't think for no code, this is the right way to do it. I think if you want to tell someone, hey, you can build Airbnb without code, there's going to be some learning. And I think it's fine. And I think people are very willing to learn tools. And we've actually seen that with our users a lot. And I think some of the tools don't necessarily fit that way. And they think that, okay, we need to make adoption easy to get a lot of users. And then it's fine if at some point people are limited by the product, because that's the trade-off, right? If you don't have too much learning curve, you're more limited by the product, then people will then hire an engineering team or go to another tool like Bubble. Our approach is different. Our approach is we're going to try to create the conditions for people to learn the product efficiently. It might take, depending on people, I've seen anything from like 2 to 3 hours to maybe 15 or 20 hours. But then you basically have the same power as a software engineer. And our commitment is that we don't want you to migrate from us. We will make sure that the product can keep scaling, both in terms of functionality and scale, in terms of number of users you have. So that you can keep working till, you know, you become acquired, the public, whatever. And I think that's a pretty unique position, actually, compared to most companies. I've been on some panels, you know, I know most of the founders or the CEOs of all the different companies, and I've been in some panels where, you know, we would actually argue a little bit on, you know, can Airbnb be built on no code? Some other people, most people in the space would say no, at some point they will need to use custom code. I disagree with that. I think they might still involve custom code that would extend the product built on Bubble. And today you can write code on Bubble if you need. Very few people do, but it is an option if you need to. But I think the future is that the company of the scale of Airbnb should be buildable on a product like Bubble, similarly to what Amazon Web Services has done with hardware. Today, you know, Airbnb, Netflix run on AWS, and then only, you know, companies like Facebook become so big that they have to use their own data centers or Dropbox. That's something I think no-code should be doing the same thing. So we want to be the platform that people don't migrate from, except maybe if you become like a massive, you know, $1 trillion company. And I think that actually is a different bet that most other people are making.
That makes
sense. And it does have a huge impact on how we build our product, where we, if there is a trade-off for us between offering more flexibility to our users versus less functionality, but the more functionality comes with more learning curve, like something you have to learn, we try to go for education and flexibility instead of oversimplifying the product. Because in my experience, even if our users are non-technical, like pretty much none of our users write code today, people want a very granular control on what they're building. And so you need to give them options.
Quick side mention, can I just ask you to switch the mic? I'm guessing it's not set to the headphones, or do you have an external mic?
I have an external mic, but this could be better.
It just sounds like a bit of echo. I just realized now that maybe the headphones, mic, it's in the lower left corner next to the mute button.
Yeah, how is that?
Oh, wow. You just 10x'd your audio.
Okay, yeah. Good.
Right. Cool. So getting back to what you were saying, you just answered one of my next questions before I even asked it, which was, where's Bubble going? Do you guys want to reduce the learning curve or so that more people can onboard faster, or are you increasing the complexity of what you can build? So you're saying you're going for complexity is a bad word, I should say. flexibility.
Flexibility is a better word. Yeah, we're not really in the phase of expanding the flexibility of the product because it's already there, honestly. Like, we're more in the mindset right now of polishing what we have, making it more reliable and robust at scale. And that's where most of the engineering work we have today goes, in making sure that if you have, you know, millions of users, it's going to work fine on our platform. So it's not more functionality, it's just handling more traffic, more users, more API calls, whatever. And then try to improve the learning curve. And that improving the learning curve can be done in many different ways. There is work we're doing in the product. So for instance, we're trying to simplify how you can get responsive pages, because that's something people are having a harder time learning compared to the workflow system, which I think is more intuitive. That can be, you know, better documentation. That can also be better marketing, honestly, because even if the learning curve is real, if it's 10 hours compared to the time it takes to learn how to code, it's honestly nothing. And so if our marketing were clear enough and people knew that after 10 or 15 hours of learning, they can have the same powers as a software engineer, and if we were able to convince them efficiently about that fact, I'm pretty sure our learning curve suddenly will become much less of a problem for people. So we're trying to tackle that on multiple fronts.
Back to my point.
Go on. And the last thing we're doing on the educational side, like I mentioned content, but we even now, you know, teaching our own classes to make sure that people can learn Bubble. So if people have a willingness to pay to accelerate their learning, so we now do boot camps where we give them an instructor with a small group of 8 people so that they can get on Bubble as fast as possible.
I like that framing. It made me think of Basecamp's pricing. First time I saw Basecamp's pricing, I said, oh, $99 a month, okay. But then they made that comparison. I don't know if you know their page where they compare Basecamp, which has a flat pricing, to stacking up Asana, Google Suite, Dropbox, and how the pricing scales.
I haven't seen that page, actually.
They framed it this way, that Basecamp is flat pricing regardless of how many users you have, 5, 10, 15. And they were showing how Asana plus Google Suite plus Dropbox plus blah, blah, blah stack up. So this price for 5, this price for 10. And what you just said made me think of that, because first time I saw Basecamp, I was like, oh, okay, let's see what they're about. But then when they framed it that way for me and I bought into the view, the same way you framed it this way of, okay, Bubble has a learning curve, but compared to learning code, it's still faster. It made me think of this reframing, which is very quantifiable in terms of time. Like, is Bubble faster than learning curve? Of course it is.
Of course it is. And this is really one of our marketing challenges. It was almost easier before no code was a thing. Now that no code is a thing, people will compare us to other no code tool. But I think our real competition here is code, really. And you know, or hiring an engineer or going on Upwork and finding, you know, some development agencies in low cost countries. And so that's a narrative that we really need to shape. Like, when people compare us to Webflow, for instance, I think Webflow is a fantastic product, but it's much closer to Squarespace and or CMS than we are to them. Like, we rarely see people using Webflow instead of Bubble when you want to build a web application. So the true competition we are against is code. And that's something that I need to communicate better on, honestly.
I get that. And ever since I've heard a couple of years ago, this thing that, you know, the real competition sometimes is nothing because people don't know it, or it's email because this, or it's code in your case, I can see why. And yeah, I guess we could talk about competition, but I want to ask you something else. Back to our point of your drive and your responsibility, that's how I would sum up, limited but summed up answer of what you were telling me earlier. Your responsibility to users and why you're doing Bubble. You also haven't charged by percentage of revenue. You have a flat pricing, at least at the starting bracket.
It's not flat because it scales with usage, but server usage, it doesn't scale with transaction volume. That's right.
Let me rephrase. They're not flat, fixed fee per month.
Right. It's not usage based.
Yeah. Okay. But it's not percentage. That's what I'm trying to get. Why not go for, give us a percentage of your revenue because we enabled you to do it. Share it with us.
Because it's technically challenging to do that. Given how open-ended the product is. The fact that Bubble is the only no-code platform, I think, where you can add any API on your own. And it's pretty easy to do so. And that's very important for us because we need people to be able to build anything. But so if you do that, I can't know. Like if I start, you know, charging a percentage on transactions on Stripe, for instance, I could. But then as soon as you start getting big, you're going to build your own API integration and bypass our pricing system, right? So that's a little bit the flip side of creating something that is very open-ended. I actually think we're closer to AWS than we are to Shopify, for instance. Mm-hmm. Would Amazon Web Services charge on percentage of transaction? No. How could they, right? I mean, they could. I guess they could look at the... they could do the same thing that we do, which is look at, you know, requests to Stripe and take a percentage from that. But it's not, Shopify or Webflow can do that because these platforms are not open-ended. They have a payment platform done with Stripe, and they use that, and so they know exactly how much it is that they can take a percentage on. We can do that as us. We're much more of a platform than we are of a SaaS, and so that's why we don't do this.
That was a softball, if this phrase means what I think it means, because I knew the answer would be something like that. And it speaks again to your approach to this. I've given you a softball. Let's take it on a hardware, but let's humanize you a bit. What was 1, 2, 3, or 0, if you don't want to answer the question? What were some tough moments in Bubble? Like maybe the toughest, maybe any moment when you said, Jesus, this is really, like I knew it was going to be hard, but not that hard.
It's probably 2015, I think, where we got toward the end of, you know, the 3-year run that we did just pushing very hard on the product and having like a small community of users that really loved us. I mean, many of them still use us today, but there were probably like 50 to 100 people at most. We were starting to see our bank accounts close to zero. I was in the 4-digit world, so less than $10,000 in my bank account, which was, and no, very little salary, so that was a little bit tough. And we didn't necessarily see high growth close, right? And that was tough. And at that point, it was still just Josh and I. We had been working together for 3 years and, you know, we still work together today. We get along, but in a relationship, you know, when not everything is easy, then you start having tough times. And that was probably the hardest. And then we started doing more communication around what we do. We in particular had a product hunt launch that went extraordinarily well still today. I mean, by today's standards, and what I'm talking about was in 2015, October 2015, it was one of the, I think, most successful launches you can have. We got like, I think like about 6,000 upvotes in a month or something. That was like really high at that point. And so we got a lot of inbound happening. And so you get the excitement of having people, you know, caring and talking about what you do. And so that got us back. And then we started making more money and then eventually hired a team. But yeah, 2015 was probably the toughest thing.
And what? No, I'll skip that question actually. You said savings were going close to zero. There's a school of thought of people who say, you know, under stress, you can perform really well. You sometimes might want to get yourself to stress. Some other people are saying, no. This is creative work. Okay, don't put yourself in a bubble, pun intended, but try to keep yourself like clear mind, because you need a clear mind to do all this creation. You had a fire under your ass. I can't put it in a better way than this. When savings were...
Yes, but I don't think that's what actually got us to perform. I don't buy that, actually. I don't buy, you know, you perform better necessarily under stress. I do think you perform better for something like Bubble in particular with very limited resources, because it forces you to be lean, because a project like that is a very long-term project. It takes a long time. You know, if just putting a lot of resources on solving the software engineering problem, which is that it's expensive to be built, to build, that would have been sold by Microsoft or Apple or Google 20, 30 years ago for Microsoft and less for Google. I mean, the company is not that old, because it's an obvious problem, right? Writing code is hard. Not many people can do it. Companies have tried to solve that for decades, and they have billions to put to that work, to that, because they're not stupid. They know the potential is crazy. And by the way, look at Microsoft, how many times they tried to solve that problem, you know?
Yeah.
And that was over the years, you know, Front Page, Microsoft Access, Power Apps today, like they all, Yahoo tried some stuff. Apple tried more in the 80s and I think went away from that, but Apple is not really of a developer platform, company. People have tried for 30 years now and they have not been able to do that, and they have unlimited resources. So the way to solve that problem is not just throw money at the problem. And so forcing ourselves to be extremely lean, not fundraise. So that's the thing that I guess I haven't said yet, but we didn't fundraise for the first 7 years, was a way to force us to really focus on what was important and, you know, making sure we had the right product before trying to market it. Because as soon as you fundraise, you're going to start marketing your product, even if it's not ready yet. And I think for something like no code, where there is a lot of skepticism from engineers in particular, but people in general, you know, because it's been tried so many times that people are like, yeah, that's good on paper, but, you know, these things don't work. And still today we hear that, even though someone has built a Twitter clone without code on Bubble, but still, you know, it takes some time to convince people. Not having raised money forced us to really focus on the product, making sure we had something extremely strong before marketing it. And looking back, I think that was the right approach. One thing I'd say that we're not the only one, actually. If you look at the other bigger startups than us, a little bit bigger than us, that do very open-ended tools, and these are, I mean, Webflow is not as open-ended as we are, but they're pretty open-ended as a tool. Notion, Airtable, Zapier, all these companies actually had a pretty slow start. You know, for the first like 5 years, they all just were building the product. And then suddenly when the product was good enough, it started really accelerating because they had a product that no one else had. And I think that's the phase we're in right now. What we did was a little bit longer, because I would argue that what we do is a little bit harder than what these companies do, because I think it's a wider scope of features that you need to build. And so that's why it took, you know, probably 8 years, where it took them like 4 or 5. But the pattern though of, you know, not raising money, being heads down on the product for 5 or 6 years before starting having like interesting growth and then raising very big rounds of funding, it's not unique to Bubble.
You said, would you agree that if you would have raised money from the beginning, seed, something like that, in that slow burn when it wasn't, it looked like it wasn't going anywhere, would you agree that if you were money raised, company would have died? Because I think that's 100%. That's an unspoken.
No, 100%. I mean, VC money is not for everything. VC money is not for companies that take 5 years of product development. Because at the end of the day, what venture capitalists and investors in general want to see is great charts. And a great chart is a chart that goes up like this, you know, exponential. Yeah. And until you have a product like Bubble, for instance, until you have a product that's good enough, you can't have that chart. So we could have shown charts of, you know, how good the product is that goes like this. And it really was, but it's hard to quantify. It's not necessarily the metric that investors are usually used to seeing. And so the problem then that if you raise a round, 18 months later, you have to raise a second round. And if you don't have those charts, you're not going to raise a second round.
Yeah, you're fucked. Yeah.
You're fucked. Exactly. And so, no, we would totally be out of business had we raised money. 100%.
I think that's one of the unspoken unspoken. It's not an advantage. It's a thing, like a feature of being bootstrapped, that if, because you said if it takes 5 years to have the product at that stage, it's no good to raise VC money unless you're in the fifth year, of course. One of the unspoken features, the fact that if it doesn't go and you still have savings or you can make ends meet somehow, you're not going to die, as opposed to a VC company has to write that post-mortem.
Yeah, exactly. And in our case, you know, we had, it forced us to find users who would pay for it. And, you know, the business was not, we were not paying ourselves a ton. And so that's why, you know, savings were going down, but the business was still supporting itself mostly. Like, you know, at that point we had maybe like, you know, $10,000 of revenue a month or something. So it's not too much, but at least, you know, it pays for the expenses of the business and would pay us a tiny bit.
Let's speak about finding users and developing for them and driving the direction. I want to ask you specifically, I usually ask people, how do you define value, user value, I mean here. But I think you're in an even better position to answer, because with Bubble, sky isn't the limit. For the multiverse, entities are the limit. Like, you can go in any direction with Bubble. You're trying to do something that allows people to do everything, or with a quick start on that everything. How do you discover that value? And I guess it's a question of product decision, but do you imagine your head and then run a scenario in this imagination machine and try to apply it to the world? Is it only talking to users? Is it that glorified Steve Jobs quote of, if I ask people what they wanted, blah, blah, blah. Walk us through your process of finding value as it drives Bubbles product.
I mean, I feel like for what we do, it's been such an old problem that it's hard to find engineers and people are trying to build things that the value was obvious. The question was more, so, you know, when we were like, is there a problem here? Which is usually what people want to discuss, right? With the startup company, is there something to actually fix here? Of course. I mean, maybe you can call that, you know, reality distortion. Then I'm actually, you know, turns out I was right, but I could have been wrong and it was not obvious at first. But to me, it's 100% obvious that, you know, creating software is expensive and hard and slow. If you can make it more accessible to people and easier and more prettier, beautiful through a visual interface, of course it's going to work. Like, come on. The question is, can you be good enough to do it? So we never really consider, you know, we need to do a market assessment, you know, are people going to want this, right? Because, yeah, it felt so obvious. Where what we did a little bit differently, though, than a lot of people is that we didn't bet on people that wanted hobbyists, or sometimes people call them makers, you know, people trying to create tools, mostly to play around and to do cool things. We were targeting entrepreneurs. And that, I think, was a very interesting move that we did, non-technical entrepreneurs, which at that point, back in 2012, 2013, was a category of people that no one really wanted to work with, because by definition, they're non-technical, so, you know, they're not very useful in tech. And they are startups, and a lot of the startups' ideas are not going to be good, so they're going to churn and fail. And we feel that it doesn't matter. These people are super driven, they're serious, they're desperate for a solution like ours. So we can give them a product that is not going to be perfect at first, because perfection takes years, if not decades, to reach. But they're going to work with whatever we give them, because that's as long as we, you know, we improve the platform, because they don't have any other option. And so we basically found these early users that desperately needed us, that were willing to deal with the limitations of the product at first, and we could iterate with them. And then how did we build the product? So it's not really about, you know, customer value here. It's more how you decide the product roadmap. Well, 100% by talking to them, because they were always telling us, hey, I need to build this feature. How can I do this? And so then our job, and that was Josh and I for the first 5 years, just the two of us, was, okay, this is what the user wants to do. Can we find a way that fits our current paradigm, our current editor, to make it possible to expose this kind of functionality without adding complexity? And the daily struggle we had to deal with as the product team at the beginning, and still today with a larger team, but for the first 5 years, just Josh and I, was really, okay, a user wants to add this. We don't want to make the editor more complicated. Can we find an elegant way to make that happen? And that's something that takes a lot of time. That's why, you know, fundraising is not necessarily going to help here, because you don't, in these early years, you don't want too many people to think about that, actually, because then it becomes messy, because people are going to come with different opinions. Having a team of just two people for 5 years was actually very valuable, because our way to solve that problem was extremely consistent. We would always, you know, be like, because we knew the product inside out, we had built everything ourselves. And that turned out to be very valuable. Now that we're bigger, we can afford having a bigger team, and we train them because we have a very strong foundation.
So somebody comes, they ask, can I do this? You would go and think of an elegant way. Then you, let's say you made it. It's one of the features that you saw the elegant way to add it. And then the product from this becomes this. Size is not 100% accurate, but you expand the product a bit. What do you do then? Do you tell the customer, we've done this, here's a guide? Do you add in the knowledge base?
I mean, usually we communicate with our users, especially back then, but a lot today still, through the forum. And so the forum becomes kind of the knowledge base. It's one of our most valuable assets today. Like, our community is extraordinarily engaged. If you go to forum.bubble.io, you'll see how much questions and conversations that are there. And so we would communicate with them and explain people there, instead of doing that by email. I've always been in favor of like more open communication with our users, because whenever you solve the problem for one person, there is another person that didn't reach out to the team, and that they might find out on the forum and it might inspire them to do something. So that we would communicate with them, and and then it becomes core of the product for everyone else.
One of the side effects you have leading Bubble is you see a shit ton of products made by the users of Bubble. I'll be looking forward to the headlines of the unicorn built on Bubble. But you also see a lot of failures with these products. A side effect is you could become a VC, I'm guessing, at a certain point, given the experience, the field experience with a plethora of products. Would you ever consider that? VC is not only to see in product, but it's an important part of it.
It'd be a fun thing. Yeah, I'd love at some point to create a structure so that we can not necessarily invest, because I don't think that's where we would be. I don't think that would be core to our business model. At the end of the day, if someone scales on the platform, we'll do well, and I hope more people do, but more as a way to help them, actually. We started doing that for some special things. We have a diversity program, for instance, called Immerse, where we help people from minorities start companies. So that's us trying to create structures that go beyond just creating a product, but accompanying people through their entrepreneurship journey. I think we can do better there. It's something that I hope next year, that's something we can start looking into. And whether it's a fund, whether it's an accelerator, whether it's free credits, there are many things we can do to try to help people succeed better, because at the end of the day, our incentives are extremely well aligned with our users. We'll only succeed if our users succeed. And now to your point, yes, there are a lot of startups that fail on the platform, and that's totally fine. In fact,
it's normal. We know the statistics.
Not only it's normal, but I think a lot of these ideas deserve to exist. You know, one of the reasons we started the company in the first, and maybe they won't work out, but that's okay. One of the main reasons we started the company in 2012 is because back in New York in 2012 was the beginning of the startup era. Like, if you remember, we were not talking too much about startups in 2010, right? And a lot of people had ideas, but no technical talent to build them. And we would, they would describe their ideas, and many of them were like, look, I don't know if this is the next Facebook, that might fail, but it definitely should be tried out, because
let's find out.
It's not a stupid idea at all. And we just felt it was wrong that all these people could not try that. And the amount of creativity we could have on the web was just limited by the pool of engineers. And so our way to fix that was like, okay, well, let's make that we don't need engineers for most of the products out there. And so, yeah, a lot of ideas fail, and that's totally fine. As long as people have a good experience on Bubble, they'll come back and build something else. Sometimes, by the way, people don't start companies. Sometimes they're going to build something for existing businesses, because a lot of people need software in existing businesses. And that's a great use case as well.
And to your point, even when products fail on Bubble, I think they also, that learning process is way faster, because the iteration on Bubble will probably be faster on average. Pretty safe to assume that.
Yeah, it's probably 10 to 50 times faster.
I meant what I said earlier with you as a VC on a personal level, on an Emmanuel level of, let's say, Bubble becomes this huge thing and you step back, step down, kind of like, I don't know, Jeff Bezos, because he just did a couple of days ago. You would have the training, the field experience, the leverage. As a side effect, it just happened that as you were growing Bubble, you had this. Is there any personal, because you have to be able to do, but you also want to do it. Would you ever be down for something like that, given the field experience?
Investment?
Yeah, as you said, maybe VC, maybe whatever kind of investment.
I'm not sure. If I were to do something, I would do it within Bubble, I think. I don't think I'm an investor at heart. I prefer doing things.
That makes sense.
If we create a structure to help companies succeed on Bubble, I see that as very core to what Bubble does. And I see that as really making Bubble succeed. Whether it's called a fund, whether it's called something else, it's an implementation detail.
Yeah, I see. Well, yeah, it has to be on appetite as well. What I meant was, if you work at Apple Music, let's say, as a side effect, you're going to learn, more and more about the music industry. It just comes as a given.
Yeah.
So same for you. But, you know, who knows what Emmanuel from 5-10 years from now will think and believe. Let's see. How much intuition is there in your process when you're working on Bubble as a product and as a business?
So this is changing over time. For the first 7-8 years, pretty much 100% intuition and anecdotal interactions with users. I've always been of the school that one conversation with three users is more valuable than 1,000 shallow conversations with a survey or something. So we've historically been more intuitive and intuitive in making our decisions than most companies, I think, and most people say we should be. And I think when you try to do something that, again, is not new, because I don't think what Bubble is trying to do is new, but it's a new way to solve it. I think it's a very good way to do it like this, because what you have new compared to other people is your intuition. And I think we had a better intuition, I think, on many things. That said, as the business gets bigger and we start having, you know, like tens of thousands of paying users and a lot of people active in the platform, then we start looking at data more, because now it starts becoming more insightful. And I wouldn't say the product is being built, but I think the fundamental of it is pretty much there. And so now we can start optimizing things, looking at actually what people are using and how much they're using it and why and stuff like that. So we started pretty much entirely on the intuition side, and we're now becoming more and more data driven.
Which I think would be the balanced way to approach it. Because in the beginning, there's a lot of uncertainty, and I mean, it's fully uncertainty.
Yeah, and at the beginning, there's no data also.
Yeah.
Like you can find data if you want, but it's not necessarily going to be reliable.
I've asked people on the subreddit, I was telling them, I'm talking to Emmanuel today, what should I ask him? The most upvoted question is, not my favorite question, but I think we can get a great answer out of it, maybe. How would you help non-technical founders evaluate the opportunity cost of learning Bubble versus taking on a technical co-founder? And I think this speaks to what you were saying earlier, that this is one of the aims now.
Yeah. I'm mostly talking to people that will never find a tech co-founder, and that's 99% of them. If your best friend from high school and you trust that person knows how to code and is excited about your idea and wants to join you, well, maybe partner with them. There are advantages with code, meaning you have a little bit more control compared to what you do with Bubble. Just so that you know, though, and I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to the prospective founder here, it will take slower, it's slower to build. Like no code technologies, and Bubble in particular, are much faster to build on. And engineers start using us today because it saves them time. That said, there are advantages having a technical person on the team if you have one. If you can't find that person, and this is 99% of people, well, you don't have any alternative, right? It's either use Bubble or not build your thing, your product. Then I think the trade-off is very different. Or, I mean, you could try to go, you know, Upwork and learn how to code, but it's going to take you years before you can actually get something to production at scale. Or go to Upwork or TopTal and try to find, you know, some engineers in remote locations. This usually does not work well, especially if you're starting a company. If you're an existing organization and you need to build something, a dev shop might actually do the work trick, because the product is not going to change too much. But when you do a startup, the product needs to change every week. And you're not going to have your whatever dev shop you're using in Eastern Europe, India, I don't know, or in some places in the US, that will be able to react quickly to every request we have, because at some point they're going to take another client. And so to these people, I very much recommend using Bubble, yes.
Not to mention the flexibility of the budget when you make all those changes with the dev shop or...
Oh yeah, I mean...
Even a freelancer at the end of the day, unless it's that hourly thing.
It's hard to assess sometimes how much savings Bubble lead to, because it's not just money, it's also time, because you can get started sooner because you're not waiting to find an engineer, and you can launch sooner because it's faster. But to ask how you, we hear anywhere from 10 to 50 times cheaper. So we've seen people, you know, generate millions in revenue without raising a dime and without engineers on the platform. I don't think it is possible without Bubble.
What about the technical people who know? Because as no-code grows and spreads, if you're not a purist and you're one of these people who say no-code isn't actually no-code because whatever, some more high and openness technical people are saying, oh, look, I know how to code. But with no-code, I can move faster. And of course, I can bring my technical skill for the long term when I'm making it, you know, this huge thing. But in the beginning, I'm just trying to get off the ground. What about the technical people who start using Bubble to have not the money cost, but the time cost?
I mean, it's a use case we're seeing more and more, actually. And it's something we're going to double down on, because what we're seeing is that it's actually important to get buy-in from engineers when they work at the company using Bubble, because at some point, even if you start a company on Bubble without engineers, you're going to start wanting to, you know, maybe develop like your own plugins or something like that on the platform, and that will take some code. And that's a pattern we see more and more, meaning instead of having a team of 10 engineers, you're going to have a team of like 5 or 6 people building on Bubble and then one engineer. But you need that engineer to like Bubble, otherwise it's not going to go well. And so that's something we see more and more. Yeah. Because smart engineers, you know, don't want to keep repeating the same thing again and again and again.
You're moving on your MVP phase of Bubble. To me, I'm very curious. I could spend hours talking about 2012 to 2015, 16, but I guess that has to be the scope of a specific podcast. We're just bouncing now. Your MVP lasted for a couple of years, or depends on what definition of MVP, but you know what I mean. What was the signal that, you know what, Joshua, this is what people call product market fit. Like, people are starting to, it's starting to get off the ground.
Probably early 2019, when we started seeing much more referral coming, people starting to pay without even talking to us. Like, people every day, you know, they come in and they start building and then eventually subscribe to a paid plan. That's what I think when we started seeing it. I'm pretty sure a lot of people could say we could claim product market fit from 2017 or 2016. I mean, it doesn't really matter. I see it mostly early 2019. That's also when no code became a thing. Like, early 2019 is when Ryan Hoover wrote this blog post that was kind of like the starting point for the no code, not movement, because I think we started it before, but getting a bigger thing in Silicon Valley. For a long time, you know, like Silicon Valley didn't like no code. It didn't have that name. But, you know, I had investors and very prominent ones, and I won't say who, told me, you know, what you're doing doesn't make sense because everyone is learning how to code. You know, what we saw in the early 2010s, like 2012 to 2015, the excitement was, it's going to be amazing. Everybody is going to be a coder. And people realize it's not working that way. And so I think Silicon Valley and the tech ecosystem at large had some love-hate relationship with no code at first. Like, they were fascinated by it, but also like, no, that can't be something that works. Now, I think that we've proven that it will work, and so people are much more buying this, and companies are raising money and everything. But it was not at all what the ecosystem was saying early, in the early days.
I know my personal stance on no code, and to people listening to this, it might be obvious as well. I'm a fan. I'm not technical. I learn how to code, but I still prefer no code. Just so that, Emmanuel, you and I don't look like no code fanatics, purists. Let's take you from the other side. What's the biggest reasonable objection of no code? And do you plan to address it? Is it in your way to address it in any way? Maybe it's not in your path.
I would say the biggest objection,
or, you know, the biggest blind spot, something like that. Let's try and poke a bit at it.
I think it depends on each tool. Like, each tool has its different blind spot. Most tools, I would say, is feature limitation and the fact that you're going to hit a dead end. It's not our problem. We don't hit dead end on Bubble. You can do pretty much anything, but you can start becoming not as performant as a hand-coded web app. And so that's kind of that's the next frontier for us. For a long time, people were telling us Bubble will never be flexible enough to build that kind of product. And I think now, if you know how to use a tool, we've pushed all these limits, really. Like, there's not much you can do really now, if you know how to combine the different things we have. But it may not be the fastest at scale. And that I think is the next frontier for us. The good news is that I don't think it's impossible at all. I think we have a very high chance, because at the end of the day, the reason apps can be slow on Bubble sometimes is gets more to the way people are building them than the fundamental technology that we have, because sometimes people make design choices that are not optimal. And we have, you know, probably a couple of million apps now on the platform. And so we can see patterns, right? We can see, you know, users tend to do the same design. From a performance standpoint, it doesn't make sense, but that's what they do. So we can automatically start doing things behind the scene to optimize that. And so that's basically a lot of what we do today. And I think there is a real, so we have a real shot at solving that problem. There are a couple of things that no-code is not great at today. That's particularly, you know, if you want to build some HIPAA compliant, like compliance aspects, you know, but it's just an operational maturity that we'll get to as soon as we can. So like probably a few months or a year away, you know, being able to handle, you know, medical data, if you're building a healthcare app on Bubble, you need to be HIPAA compliant in the US, and then other countries have other standards. That's something we can do, but there's nothing impossible here. It's just about, you know, us working and making that possible for our users. So where I'm going with this is that we need, there is a lot of work ahead of us, but I don't think there is any major roadblock that makes that we will not work out if we do our job properly.
I want to push back a bit on a certain thing you actually brought up. I was going to do it anyway, but it's good that you brought it up. One of the biggest complaints I've seen, and again, this might be from purists, but they say, okay, no code, fine, it works. They finally accepted that it's here. It's been knocking on the door of Silicon Valley. And as you said, in 2019-ish, the door was finally open, accepted. The biggest complaint was, okay, it's here, but no code, okay, you don't need the coding skill, but you still need the coding mentality, or you need to understand what a database is and how, at the end of the day, it's information stored somewhere, it's an API call, whatever. That's one of the biggest objections I've seen to no-code, which is a valid one, which...
No, it's not.
Go on. Why?
Are you saying that if you don't know how to code, you can't understand what a database is? This is really the most insulting thing you can say. I know a ton of people that don't write code and they totally understand what a database is.
In here, I'm trying to be the voice for these people. It's not my business, I know, as I said.
I'm not talking to you. I'm talking for people who say that.
Let me put it better for them. They say, okay, you might not need the skill, but you still need to think like a coder because you need to understand what a database is.
And so the beautiful thing is that for one coder, I can find 100 people who are smart enough to think like a coder. It's not because you haven't been put into a computer at 12 and your father or your mother told you, hey, learn how to code, this is cool, but you're not capable of understanding what a database is. You know, anyone who uses Excel today knows what a database is.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Excel is a database, right?
Excel was the first no-code tool.
Exactly, right? So people who say that, I don't understand why people say that. Like, there is this idea that if you can't write ifs and else with the right comma at the right place, you can't understand the structure of an application and you can't write, you can't understand what a database is. So basically what these people are implying is that product managers are a myth, right? Because they don't exist, they don't know how to code. So how can they work on a product? Of course they can. Like there are a ton of people who can do that. And if we can turn with Bubble, you know, all ex-users into software engineers, they can build software, we'll have a fantastic impact on the world. I mean, that's something people say. Honestly, I don't know what I say that because it's been proven outside of Bubble that it's totally possible to think about an application carefully without writing code yourself.
People are asking as well, what's one new feature we can look forward in 2021? And I know when you're in Emmanuel's shoes, you like we from the outside, we see Bubble today, but you see Bubble 2022, 23. In 2 months from now, is there something you feel like hinting at, maybe announcing if you feel like it?
I mean, it's not going to come as a surprise, something we've already communicated on. We're very open about our roadmap with our users. There is the most exciting thing I think we have coming up this year, and one of the most awaited for, it's not a feature, but it's the next generation of our product, is on building responsive pages. The problem we had, and I think it was, this is the nature of building a complicated product. When we built the product in 2015, the way to build responsive pages, Flexbox was not a big thing at that point. And so we basically built our own implementation of Flexbox in JavaScript. And so from a technology standpoint, it's pretty cool because it was a team of two guys doing that. The problem is Flexbox really took off after that and is now becoming the new standard. And so we have to catch up with that. And so the next implementation of our responsive engine will be using traditional CSS technologies, which will improve dramatically performance, making sure that people can understand how the responsive page engine works because it's going to be documented in other places. The challenge for us today is to find the right interface to not really expose all the CSS Flexbox properties like other tools do, because our mission is to make, you know, technology accessible, not to just have a user interface and code. And so we need to find the right controls to make that happen. But that's something that should have like a major impact on our users' lives. Then we have a full editor redesign, which is a different project, but somewhat related, because our editor is a little bit dated and we had to do some refactoring to make the product easier to evolve. So that's something, I don't know if it's, I hope it comes out later this year. And then after that, this is much further in time.
That was one of the last question I've got from you, which is everybody's itching to know on the forums, which I know you check, when is mobile responsiveness coming?
I mean, it is responsive. It's just not great today, and we're hoping to make it great.
But yeah, you just addressed it. All right, leave this this world, SaaS, no code, maybe even business, although they're all intertwined. What's for Emmanuel outside professional life?
What's the question? Like, what do I like to do outside of work?
Yeah, what's balancing your professional work? Some people like, I like watches, for instance. Some people like cycling, whatever, stuff like that. I guess I'm asking, what are your hobbies? But
you're catching me at a very weird spot because I just had a baby. And so my life is...
So they all have to go...
Baby stuff, right? So I don't really have hobbies anymore these days. And I think taking care of your baby is probably the best hobby you can have. I mean, it's not a hobby, but it's very much a better thing to do than doing a lot of hobbies. If you ask me what I like doing, though, I love sailing. I grew up on the shore in Normandy where the water is cold, but you can sail and it's really fun. I'm very passionate about my home country. And so I go there a lot and I try to, I would love to be more active in France at some point and move back and do things once bubble is behind me, but not right now. Right now I'm really focused on what I'm doing, but that's something I spend quite some time, whether, you know, it's reading or talking with people to figure out, you know, how we can make our country better. And yeah, but today, like this year is mostly baby stuff. And that's awesome.
Two full-time jobs, bubble and family, especially now with the...
Yeah, well, I'm not the first one who got through that, you know, like a lot of founders at some point have babies, right?
Yeah.
That's the story of life.
A second full-time job, yeah. Where's... If bubble becomes this big thing you're seeing, and it is a bet, and as I said, you know my stance on it, do you think it has implications? It's a bad question. Of course it has. What implications does it have on the way we work? On the way... So we're... You know, the pandemic changed a bazillion things, and one of them is this thing of, no, we don't want to come back to the office. We want remote. I don't want to get into the political discussion of it, of that, but... If bubble really enables everybody, literally everybody, to make a product without requiring anybody else, what implications do you think it will have on the way we work, the way business is made and all that?
I think it will have two major effects. It will enable more innovation. So more people will come up with product to solve problems at a more localized level. One of the big issues we see today is engineering is so expensive that if you're not working on something that can become at least $100 million, if not $1 billion valuation, it's very hard to raise money. And therefore these ideas don't happen. And I think it's actually very wrong because software can be used in many places that are much smaller, where the financial outcome is not necessarily as big, but it would actually make people's life easier. And I think lowering the cost of creating technology and making it easier, like we do, would be a way to help have software in more places, whether it's geographies or types of organizations or companies, where the financial outcome is not what matters, but it would still improve the life of people a lot. So, and that can also be true inside existing organizations. What we're going to see if something like, if bubble succeeds, is people will not have to deal with, you know, legacy, horrible software that was developed 20 years ago that, you know, big companies still use today because they don't want to rebuild it because it's too costly. And instead you will see individual teams start building, not individual teams, but smaller teams start building their own tooling. And so when you ask me, how is it going to change how we work? It will basically make that people will be able to come up with their own solutions to their problems. And you will see solutions emerging from the ground up. from the bottom up, you know, not being top down because the CTO office says, okay, let's build that. And I think that will end up making most organizations more efficient. People will be happier at work that way because they don't need to deal with some crappy software that's legacy and built 20 years ago. And I think this is already something that has started. Like companies, it's not like companies have not invested in improving toolings, their toolings. That said, it's still too slow and too expensive to create. And so if you can do that with a product that makes creating technology more accessible and cheaper, it will be much faster. That will be a much faster revolution.
Here's a hot take I haven't seen online. I want to know if you ever thought of it, and if you did, what extra insight you would have on it because you had more time. If not, let me know what you think. In the Innovator's Dilemma, Clayton Christensen talks about how the smaller company who does this product at a certain segment of the market, which looks kind of not that interesting to the bigger company, disrupts it eventually. Small one disrupts big. And when asked, I paid close attention to this question to Clayton of, okay, how do we avoid that? And he says, well, most of the time, it's a smaller subset of the company, maybe a small team, preferably separate from them. IBM did this successfully in a certain moment. That's how you avoid it. I think with Bubble, that can be happening more often. If the threshold for creating something is lower, and as you, when you said the word innovation, this whole thing came to my mind. Have you ever thought of it, of Bubble and the Innovator's Dilemma's antidote being closer?
Yeah. I mean, I've also thought that we are a typical example of, if we succeed, we'd be a typical example of Christensen's theory. Because what we're trying to disrupt here is traditional engineering that is very expensive, and we come with something much cheaper that engineers don't want to do, like something like no code, because they don't think there is potential here. And so I think it applies at both levels. Yes, I think we can be an example of that disruption mechanism. And I think we can be a tooling to enable more people to do things. Yes, totally.
Do you think...
it's actually an unfortunate thing. I didn't get to take his class before he passed away. I didn't get in. Like, they had like a lottery. It's a very demanded class at Harvard. And I didn't get to take his class. And that was unfortunate.
Well, we still have the teachings online. So that's the second best thing.
Yeah, we have the books. Yeah.
Would you agree that engineering is going... This upsets some people, but whatever. Do you agree with this view that engineering is becoming commoditized, or is going in that direction?
I mean, it's definitely going that direction, and it's not Bubble, it's in general. One thing I'd say is that even if it is getting commoditized, it's usually the non-complicated engineering that is getting commoditized, and so that engineering should be automated or being enabled through tools that don't require you to be an engineer, AKA Bubble. But there will always be work for engineers to work on interesting problems. That's something that people should not worry about.
100%. So maybe that school of thought that if you're an engineer, it's kind of like that narrative of don't be a truck driver because self-driving vehicles and all that. Of course, there's always going to be work for the best engineers. But yeah, commoditize would mean at the base level, or as you said, with the simple tasks.
Yeah.
Are you spiritual in any way? Are you purely... Their spirituality is their religion. Some people are spiritual without being religious.
I believe in humans and humanity.
Where's humanity going?
I'm very excited. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I think I'm excited. Currently, I think we're a little bit in a phase where people are lost a little bit. But overall, I mean, I think human progress is something that is very, has been able to solve a lot of problems in the long term, and that's highly exciting. I think currently there are a few things going on that are not going very well, and we need as a society to think a few things, including actually our rapport to technology and the fact that the way technology is currently being built, to go back to Bubble, it turns most people into only consumers and not creators, and I think that's really a problem. That I'm trying to solve at my level with Bubble. I think we need to figure out a way so that, you know, everyone can keep contributing and creating new things online, because that's where the world is going. And if you can't do that, you're not going to be able to sustain yourself in an intelligent way and a fruitful way for yourself and rewarding way. But overall, although I think humanity is going into a good direction. And if you look at history over, you know, a long period of time, we live better today than people were living to you 200 years ago and places like this. So I'm very hopeful still.
What are we missing to address those caveat, that feeling of lostness that you mentioned earlier as humanity? What's missing?
I think this generation, I mean, people today have harder time to step back, I think. And I don't know if it's called about, you know, disconnecting from your devices. I think it's good deeper than this, but stepping back and asking ourselves, you know, what's going on, what's going well, what's not going well, is something that I think we're not being great at. Now, to be honest, I was not there in 1950 or like 1890. So I can't tell you whether at that point we were much better then. So we'll see, maybe it's fine that in the short term we have that, and in the long term things still play out okay. But if you ask me at a micro level what I'm seeing like right now, I think that's something that we could do a better job at.
Coming back to ping-ponging between deep topics and back to SaaS and business, if you would start another business today, knowing you have this experience from Bubble, which was a slow burn, long-term bet, would you still do a long-term bet? You know, assuming, because something like that, you can't just sit down and say, okay, I'm going to think of an idea. And then in 3 days you say, okay, I have this long-term bet. Would you do it that way again, assuming you have one? Or would you go for something that is looking to materialize faster? Like, again, the example I give is a bit of a basic example, but it's starting an email marketing company today, let's just say. So that's something that, you know, people...
I wouldn't.
Beginning off the ground. Go on.
I'm more excited about the end goal and what we're trying to achieve and the journey. Like, I'm a fairly patient person, and I believe that great things take time to build. And I don't need like quick success. It's fine. But I want to do something that I think the world really needs. And I think the world needs something like Bubble more than another email marketing company.
What makes you... I'm glad we got to the core of it, because I was slowly chipping at this. What do you think makes you patient that other people are missing when they're in a hurry, when they're in neediness?
I mean, I'm not saying they're missing. And there are a lot of people that are patient out there. So I don't want to claim all the, you know, the monopoly for patience.
There's many people which are impatient in this world that we talk
about. Yeah, but to be fair, I think Josh and I had also, you know, I guess we had savings. Like, there were a few things at that point of our life. We didn't have families. There were things that gave us a freedom to be patient. I wouldn't say this is patience that we had that other people didn't have. It's probably stubbornness. We're more stubborn, and we really wanted to finish what we started. And so that becomes patience. But patience is not necessarily the primary thing. Patience is more the consequence of our stubbornness. Why did we care so much about this? Why didn't we want to finish it? Well, I've already covered that a little bit, right? Started with the fun of it, then the moral commitment. And then at the end of the day, yeah, I guess I was raised and Josh was raised in a way that when you start something, you finish it. And well, even if it takes 10 years or 20 years, you finish it.
Do you see yourself working on Bubble for the rest of your life? If it requires,
I mean,
that.
Rest of my life, I don't know. I mean, hopefully I have many decades to come still. But I mean, I could definitely see me for another 10, 15 years, yes.
Does that idea excite you, that Bubble was something you started and it was your whole life's work, kind of like, I can't think of an example.
Yeah, because I think this is one of the bigger problem. Like, people don't see that like that. And in 2021, I'm not going to make the claims this is the biggest problem in the world, because we had a difficult last 18 months. But I do think computer literacy is a big problem to solve. If I can solve that and solve that as a global scale, because that's the beauty of technology, is that if you solve that in New York, you solve it that for everyone in the world, because software can go anywhere. I think this is like, I would be very proud of what I've achieved if I can do that.
Do you have, and feel free to refuse to answer this, some people don't as a principle, do you have any predictions, any things that you see that might come out true, which you want to immortalize now on this recording?
No, I wouldn't pretend I have something smart to say on that one.
Why don't you make predictions? Ask people that when they refuse.
No, I do. I have some opinions things, but yeah, I'd rather use a joker here because I don't think this is worth being on the record. Yeah.
Cool. What's an important truth that very few people agree with you on? This is Peter Thiel's question, which I like asking people.
In the context of bubble, or yeah, I guess
anything.
Anything. It's not in the context of a bubble, because if it's other things, you can ask, how do you know? And
I guess with bubble, you're also speaking with your actions. So it could be bubble, it could be something outside of bubble.
I don't know if it's unique, but I know a lot of people would not follow that, but don't necessarily, yeah, don't create a product that the product that people want, immediately. I mean, it is very much like what Steve Jobs would say. I think Josh and I had the vision for a product that we knew 5 years from now, at that point when we started, once the product is good enough and once we have an initial community of users that would learn it, people would actually start being like, okay, that's really cool. Well, everyone was telling us we're losing our time and this was a lost. And the rationale we were hearing was, you know, you need to find an immediate market today. And if it does not go big quickly, it's not going to work. And I think we were able to see further in the future that there was a need there that was not so, it was not possible to solve that need, except if you put 5 years of initial work before you get there. And that's something that not many people, I think, are willing to make that bet. That said, I don't think we are the only ones either.
Could you repeat that first sentence of the answer?
I don't remember.
Doesn't matter. I'll just go over the recording. That makes sense. What's next for Bubble? Besides this roadmap we've slowly taken an answer from. On whatever level you want.
I think now Bubble is ready to move into like a cool tool that some people know but not many, into becoming a household name and becoming the new way to build things online. And that's my personal goal, I guess, for the next, like, you know, a personal goal as being really what I see as my responsibility for the business, for the company, for the next 18 to 24 months. I want 2 years from now, you know, when someone in high school needs to build something for a class project and it requires some kind of building a little app or something, they know that Bubble is there to do this. I think no one really today has that positioning. I think the world needs something like this, and I think we have the best position to do that. And so that's really what I'm going to be working on. And what that means is, you know, obviously work on the marketing, polishing on the product side, performance and scalability. Like, there is an entire roadmap that we need to deliver on this to make that happen. But fundamentally, that's where I'm going.
So you know how they say that as a CEO, you need to fire yourself every few months, every year at least. Is that, yep. Am I reading correctly between the lines here? You're firing yourself from what you've been doing so far and putting yourself into this.
No, I'm not firing myself, but the only way to scale a business is to make that you're not needed 6 months later to do something. So you don't fire yourself, you just change the task you do. Because if you keep doing the thing you would, if I were still doing what I was doing 9 years ago, well, Bubble would just be Josh and I, and I would not go very far, you know.
So that's what you do. You're switching gears into what you just said, which is call it.
Yeah, well, right now it's about, you know, finding the right people, empower them to do a better job than you would do, to do different things. And then you move to the next thing. Like it's a kind of an endless stream of things to do, and that's fun.
What's your life philosophy? Do you have one? Do you not think about this and you just go? Some people do that. Don't sit, they say, I just go with the flow. I don't think about this. Or do you have a guiding principle?
I think about what I'm doing. Yeah, I mean, as long as you're doing something useful and creating value, you want to do something real and keep pushing.
So aim to create value and keep at it.
And create value in my case means create something that actually is useful for our users. And when I mean useful, I mean useful more than fun, actually. I'm not a toy creator. I think some tools currently on the internet are more like, again, things that people use to create little things that are fun, but not necessarily where they can actually run like a company on, I'm much more into creating something that is truly useful. When I get people emailing us, telling us that they hired 10 people without funding, thanks to a bubble product, that's the best thing that can happen to me.
Do you have a moment in your that comes up to mind quickly when you say, like, that was the proudest moment or one of the proudest moments? There's a lot of answers that can come up here, but I mean in relationship to users, to customers from Bubble.
Yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing stream of little interactions, but yes, I mean, we get bottles of champagne, chocolate, like the recognition we get from our users who use us and are able to do things is just incredible. It's probably less today because now we're bigger and so people don't think that it makes sense to send us chocolate. I would love to get more chocolate. But when it was the short night, it was two guys and the community knew that. And so they knew that if they email send us something in the mail, it would come to us, right? And that was like a very cool feeling.
So if you're listening to this and you're a Bubble user and you really want to thank Emmanuel, send him some chocolate for the love of God.
Well, I'd rather something else. I'm not a fan of chocolate. But
okay, something to surprise him, but nothing too surprising, like something nice. I'm hoping
we don't have to love. We see, and even on like social media, for instance, like 2 years ago, our users were very quiet on Twitter. And now our users tweet a lot. For instance, like when I see this kind of like public announcement about, I remember a user sometime once saying, you know, wow, Bubble is incredible. I'm mind blown. My mind is blown or something. I was like, wow, that's, you know, that's why we do this, you know?
And I think that gives you a bit of a jetpack boost in this next in what you were telling me earlier, in this next phase where you're building a brand.
Yeah.
Cool. Emmanuel, before we close this, is there anything we've missed? Is there, I ask this question usually at the end. Is there a question you'd like to be asked because you have a really strong answer, or no question at all?
No, I think that was one of the deeper interviews I've done in a long time. So we did cover a lot of things.
Do you like deep conversations, or do you prefer to stick to business and...
Oh, no, I prefer actually a non-business conversation.
I'm thinking now what else I could have asked.
Well, that will be for another time.
Sorry?
That will be for another time.
Yeah, let's keep it for another time. Emmanuel, thanks for being here. What's your main platform which you're using for people to follow you, to keep up with you?
I mean, I'm not super active on Twitter, but that's probably where I respond when people send me a message there. So people can find me on Twitter. You can follow Bubble on Twitter at Bubble is there. And then if people want to get in touch, we're not that big of a company. So if someone addresses a message to me that is relevant to me and send that to our support team at supportbubble.io, it will come to me eventually, so and pretty quickly. So that's probably the best way to interact.
I love that. I'll be sending you a chocolate emoji.
Oh, LinkedIn, actually. LinkedIn is getting some steam, interestingly enough, as a social platform.
I'll send you a chocolate emoji in the DM. I appreciate you doing this. We've got an AMA with you pretty soon after this episode is published. So for anybody listening to this and that might have any question to Emmanuel, he'll be happy to help as much as he can. Thanks for doing this, Emmanuel. I love that conversation and... at both levels, both the deep and the business level.
Yeah, that was fun. Thank you very much for having me.
Cool. Enjoy the rest of the day. Cheers.
Thank you. Bye-bye.